This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations. U.S. Press Secretary Sean Spicer this week dug himself into a hole when he compared Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to Hitler during a press conference.
We didn't use chemical weapons in World War II. You know, you had a, you know, someone as despicable as Hitler, who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons. I think when you come to sarin gas, he was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly, I understand your point. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was not in the he brought him into to the Holocaust Center. I understand that. But I'm saying in the way that Assad used them, where he went into towns, dropped them down to innocent into the middle of towns, it was brought to it. So the use of it, and I appreciate the clarification there. That was not the intent.
Of course, Hitler did indeed use chemical weapons on his own people and led a regime that killed millions of Jews and others. In an interview on CNN hours later, Spicer made this apology.
Well, clearly, anybody who not just suffered in the Holocaust or is a descendant of anybody, but frankly, anyone who was offended by those comments, it's not, as I said, I'm not, you know, in any way standing by them. I was trying to draw a comparison for which there shouldn't have been one. It was insensitive and inappropriate. So I'm not looking to quantify this in any way. It was an attempt to talk about, I should have stayed focused on the Assad regime and the dangers that they have brought to their own people and the terrible atrocities they did, and to drag any other comparison into this was not appropriate.
The Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect has called for Spicer to be fired over the remarks. While his stunning ignorance was shocking, the Donald Trump administration has courted reactionary and even racist and fascist movements that follow Hitler's ideology. During his campaign, Trump retweeted the remarks of white supremacists, and neo-Nazi groups showed their support for his presidency. Today, we'll examine the role of language in the rise of the white supremacist movements that are enjoying a resurgence of power with Trump in the White House. My guest is George Lakoff. He's a professor in the Graduate School in Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also the director of the Center for the Neural Mind and Society. He's written several books, including Don't Think of an Elephant, which was just republished, as well as Moral Politics and the Political Mind. Welcome to the program, George Lakoff.
Always a pleasure, Sonali.
So first, let's get into some of the kind of the blunder that Sean Spicer made earlier this week. The big news of the week coming out of the Trump administration, and just the kind of ignorance that he displayed is really quite stunning. But I'm wondering if some of the neo-Nazi supporters of Trump were celebrating, because there is sadly a lot of Holocaust denialism. You just don't expect it to come from the highest echelons of our government, right?
Exactly. I mean, it's outrageous.
This kind of ignorance that we see of something that's so well established, you know, we expect our politicians to know this history. We expect them to be able to speak about it with some moral clarity. Do you think that Sean Spicer's blunder might have really been a blunder, or do you think there might be something more insidious going on here, given that Trump has embraced the likes of Steve Bannon, whose previous outfit, Breitbart, amplified the voices of white supremacists?
I don't think so. I think it was simply the fact that he simply did not know anything about the Holocaust, that he did not know that Hitler put 6 million Jews in gas chambers and killed them. He had no idea of the magnitude of this as one of the most horrific things in the history of humankind. And for him not to know that is unbelievable.
This administration has often sort of ignored the associations that it has had with white supremacist groups, with neo-Nazi groups. I sort of imagine what would happen if we had that, if we had neo-Nazi groups showing up to the campaign events of any other major party political candidate. And even when Trump himself has been asked about anti-Semitism, it has taken him so much pushing to actually come out and denounce it. Do you think they're playing a very dangerous game here?
Absolutely. I think that Trump and the people in the White House know that they have followers who are neo-Nazis, and that they're important followers. They're people on the alt-right. And the alt-right is a very important part of the 35% who still think are still supporting Trump.
I'm so glad you brought up that issue of 35%. We often forget that it was about that percentage of the electorate that voted for him, right?
So a little bit more. He got 46%, so it's about 9% above that.
So let's talk about the way in which language is used. You and I have talked at length about how Democrats just often lose the game that Republicans play on using language to frame ideas and convincing the masses of Americans to often vote against our own interest. But how about the language that some of these fringe organizations and movements use? I mean, you know, in general, we want to dismiss them because they are fringe, but because they're becoming more sadly popular, or seem to be becoming more popular because of Trump in the White House, I think it is important. Is the, you know, it used to be that racist language was easy to identify. Today, is it much more cloaked?
Not that much. You just need to have the right vocabulary. When they refer to people who are gay or LGBT, you know, who are transgender, they use a word like snowflake, as if they are delicate and flakes, you know. And then you have the word cuck, as in cuckold, and the idea is that they are going to be cuckolding the left by. You know, being stronger, more masculine, et cetera. They have strict father morality, and they celebrate it, and they celebrate masculinism.
Masculinism, is that the sort of counter to feminism?
Yes, very much so. That's part of the alt-right is masculinism.
Should we be calling them alt-right, George? Or, I mean, that name just seems so vague.
Well, the problem is they are arch-conservatives, but they have no moderation whatever. So they have strict father morality. I can go over what that is for your viewers. And they have no moderation to it, whereas most people who are conservatives and have that form of what they think is morality, are at least moderate in many cases. So this is the extreme right.
Should we be referring to the alt-right as white supremacist and extremist rather than the alt-right?
No, because it's much worse than that. Believe it or not, there are extremists, and there. But we don't have a good term for people who have strict father morality and no moderation, whatever. Let me talk a little bit about strict father morality, which is the view that everything, all politics is moral. It depends upon right and wrong. For example, if somebody says, follow my policy, here's my policy, the assumption is that it's right, not wrong, or it doesn't matter. And then if you have opposite policies, people have opposite views of what's right and wrong. Now, in a strict father family, father knows best. Father has absolute authority, and that's very important. That is, his job is to teach his children right from wrong, to make sure his spouse does what he says. And what he says is right, by definition. And what children are supposed to do is not do what feels good, but do what the father tells them. Conservatives talk about feel-good liberalism, which means that liberals just do what feels good. They don't do what a strict father tells them to do. Now, and that they've been raised wrong. So the idea here is that if children don't do what feels good to them, but rather what their father tells them to do, then that takes discipline. And if they have that discipline, they can go out into the world and be prosperous. So that if they're not prosperous, it means they don't have discipline, they can't be moral, and they deserve their poverty. Hence the view that poor people are lazy. But it gets worse than that. Because if you believe that a strict father has his authority by virtue of knowing right and wrong, that means that there is a correlation between a physical authority and morality. And what that says is that this is a natural thing in the world. And if it's natural, well, the way you can find out who is better than who and who is more moral than who is by looking at who has won out over history. So religions have won out, and you have a moral hierarchy. For example, you have God above man, religions have won out, man above nature, we're conquering nature, nature is there for us to take anything we can from it. Then it goes down further. You have the strong above the weak. We need to have a strong army to beat everybody else. You have the rich above the poor, they're more disciplined, employers above employees. And then it goes down, adults above children. In 21 states, there are laws that say that that teachers and coaches can beat children with sticks if they don't do exactly as they're told and if they don't show respect. In addition to that, you have Western culture above non-Western culture. The Western culture has won out. Then you have further America above other nations, men above women, whites above non-whites, Christians above non-Christians, straights above gays. That is the moral hierarchy.
And so this, identifying this in their mind, natural hierarchy, is comfortable, right? Especially when they're at the top.
It follows, it's not just comfortable, it is a consequence. It just follows that this whole hierarchy is part of one idea, strict father morality. That, you know, the strict father knows right from wrong. And not only that, if people don't follow him, a child that doesn't listen has to be punished. And it's called tough love. That's the name, it has a name, tough love. So, you know, when Trump goes and punishes people who don't listen to him or contradict him, he's required to do that by strict father morality, or he'd be considered weak. Right. So this is, it's part of one whole idea. Now, many people are not just strict, don't have just strict father morality. And by the way, this explains why people who are poor vote against their interests. That is, many poor people, especially men, have strict father morality. They believe in it. And if you have that view of morality, it defines who you are. That is, your moral view, your idea of right and wrong is deep, because you always want to think of yourself as being right, as doing the right thing. And that becomes part of your self-definition. Now, what that says is your self-definition is more important than material things. It's more important that you, although material things back up the idea of being strong and so on, that is more important than just your income and things like that. And that's why a lot of poor conservatives will vote for people like Trump and vote Republican on the basis of saying that their view of morality, their definition of who they are, is more important than other things. They vote their self-definition. That's one of the reasons that Trump won, and the Democrats had no idea that lots of those people in Michigan and Wisconsin had strict father morality to that extent.
Now, George, yeah. The Democrats often sadly fail to counter this effective use of language by the Republicans and by Trump, et cetera. But what about ordinary people? Today, social media is in strong use. We, you know, before newspapers break stories, often social media passes it around. People pass it around, stories through social media. How can ordinary people, from understanding what you are saying about framing and language, rewrite our sort of cultural language, our framing, so that we can set the standard and the stage that we hope politicians and the media will echo?
Well, first of all, you have to understand how it got the way it is. Back in 1994, when Gingrich, took over the Congress, the Leadership Institute in Virginia was set up. And you can go to their website, Leadership Institute, and they'll be very proud to tell you that in their first 20 years, they trained 159,000 people to think and speak conservative and then go out into their local communities all over the red states and to get, you know, be on a listserv, to get talking points every day, and then to be booked on radio and TV and in various local venues like high schools and so on. And they've been doing this for nearly a quarter of a century, over and over, every day. And then it comes out in Rush Limbaugh and other Fox News and so on. That this is what the language does is activate that moral viewpoint. And it activates frames that fit that moral viewpoint. And what's happened is that this has changed people. It has changed people who are mostly progressive but partly conservative, and makes them more and more and more conservative. And the reason is this, that when you hear a word that has a conservative meaning over and over and over, what that does is strengthen the meaning of that in your brain. Your every idea you have and every bit of language you have is characterized by a brain circuit. That circuit gets stronger the more it's activated. And so if the language is repeated over and over and over, it gets activated over and over and over. You know, which is why you know, Trump kept saying crooked Hillary, crooked Hillary, crooked Hillary. It kept saying it over and over until people started, you know, were thinking about Hillary as crooked. And this is really important thing, that if you have to repeat things and get them out there, and you have to get them into public discourse. As a result, what we're doing now is starting a citizens communication network for free to any activist or activist group who wants it. Right now it's running off of my Twitter feed and my official Facebook page. So if you go to at George Lakoff, capital G, capital L, you'll get all this information and so on. But we've given you lots of things to think about and to use. For example, Trump administration wants to get rid of regulations. It says we're going to get rid of three quarters of the regulations. And for every one new regulation, we're going to drop two. Well, what exactly does that mean? What it means is something very important. It means that regulations are the way that corporations talk about things, but regulations are all protections. Regulations are made to protect the public. That's why they're there, like, you know, environmental regulations, food and drug regulations, and so on. What they really are saying is that they're going to get rid of three quarters of the public protections. And that for every two public protections, you know, every one new one, they're going to drop two old ones. They don't talk about it that way, but you have to talk about it that way. That changes things.
Well, George, I am so glad to hear about this Citizens Communication Network because I think it's something we all need to be learning how to use language more effectively to so that we can promote our values. George, I know you're going to be in Los Angeles this Thursday. So for our Southern California audience, you can catch George Lakoff on Thursday, April 13th from 7 to 9 p.m. He's going to be speaking at the Iman Cultural Center, 3376 Motor Avenue in L.A. The event is entitled What to Do Now, How We Can Win with the Right Message. George, thank you so much and good luck with the event.
Always great to talk to you, Sonali, anytime.
Thank you so much. George Lakoff is a professor of the Graduate School in Cognitive Science and Linguistics at UC Berkeley, director of Center for the Neural Mind and Society. He's written several books, including Don't Think of an Elephant, which was just republished, Moral Politics and the Political Mind, and more. His website is georgelakoff.com. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.